morning. My name's Mike. I'm part of the leadership team here. And over as we approach Easter, over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at Jesus' trial. And we're going to look at the account that John has of Jesus' trial. So in the next hour that we have together as a church, we're going to spend some time thinking about this passage from John 18. And then after that, Claire's going to lead a time of response. I think we've got some testimonies as well. And some prayer time. So that's what we're going to do for the next hour. We're going to start our time with thinking about this passage from John 18. I'm looking at the first half of the trial, which is this section at the end of John 18. And then Vincent next week is going to be looking at the second half of the trial in John 19. But here's your starter for 10. Take a moment to confer with your neighbour to answer the following question. How many ruling monarchs are there in the world today? Too many is the short answer. You're going to like my second question there. Ask your neighbour. Right, so who says below 10? Below 10? 36? Somewhere in between? 230? 135? Okay. Well, according to, sorry, Jonathan, 5. 5 or 230, that's the spectrum. Well, according to a couple of sources on the internet, there are thought to be 29, and here they are. How many countries are there? That's not the same question, there you go. So, here's my follow-up question, and an opportunity to weed out any Republicans. Ask your neighbour, in the best case scenario, what would you say was the job of a king or a queen? What answers have you got? What's the job of a king or a queen? Pardon? Drink tea, right? Abdicate was one. Sorry. Smile and wave. Okay. Sorry? Bring in the tourists. Very good. Well, they're all interesting answers, but the reason I ask is that our passage this morning has at its centre Jesus confirming his royal status and the job he has come to do. And as we approach Easter, we're going to reflect on that job and its implications for us. So grab a Bible from behind you if you haven't already done so, and turn to page 1026. We're going to read from John 18, verse 28, through to the end of the chapter. And it's Jesus before the Roman governor Pilate. You can think of Russell Crowe in Gladiator when he was a Roman Empire, because he was as brutal as that. So that's not a better reference point. Whether he's a real man or not, that's another question. The passage has several characters, so I've asked a few people to read it for us. We have Dan playing the Jewish leaders. Dan, if you can come up. We have Paul playing Pilate. We have Edward as Jesus, if you can come up. And Caroline is going to be our narrator. So, John 18, verse 28.
To execute anyone.
This took place to confirm what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. Pilate then son of Annas summoned Jesus and asked him,
"Aren't you the king of the Jews? Is that your own idea? Or did others talk to you about me?"
"Am I a Jew? Your own people, the chief priests, handed you over to me. What is it you've done?"
"My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place."
"You are a king."
"You say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me."
"What is truth?"
With this, he went out again to the Jews' gathering and said,
"I find no basis for charge against him, but it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at a time of the Passover. Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?"
"No, not him. Give us Barabbas."
"No, Barabbas.
So, did you see Jesus' job description in the middle there? It's verse 37. Jesus answered, "You say that I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." And as we reflect on this, I want us to consider three things. I want us to consider, what does it mean that Jesus claims to testify to the truth? To consider the nature of truth. And I want us to consider a choice that needs to be made. But first, a bit of context. Jesus' trial has come about because of the Jewish religious leaders' growing opposition to him. Throughout the book of John, they have felt increasingly threatened by his popularity and his teaching. So much so that in chapter 11 of the book, John records their decision to have him killed. Now flip back to the start of chapter 18, where their plan begins to play out. The first part of the chapter is focused on Jesus' arrest in a garden. From verse 19, John records an initial session of questioning that Jesus faced in front of a Jewish leader called Annas. He hopes to find some incriminating evidence to justify a death sentence. But his questioning achieves nothing, so he sends him to the current high priest, Caiaphas. Following this next interrogation, we know from Mark and Luke's books that the court decides that Jesus is guilty of blasphemy, namely falsely claiming to be God. And that's a crime that justifies the death sentence. But because the Romans are in charge, the Jews have no authority to enforce it. So in verse 28, they take their prisoner to Pilate to have him carry out the sentence. And that's where our reading starts. First thing Pilate wants to do, verse 29, establish the charges. Now clearly, a charge of blasphemy is a theological issue, and that's of little consequence to Pilate. And his opening question to Jesus in verse 33 is about his royal credentials, suggests that the Jewish rulers have already reframed their charges and present Jesus as a political problem. Here is a rebel king with intent to overthrow the Romans. And you can see that their change in the accusation in verse 12 of chapter 19. But Pilate remains unconvinced, so wants to question Jesus directly. He wants Jesus to confirm his royal status. And the emphasis in his opening question is all on the word "you." "Are you the king of the Jews?" Asked almost in disbelief. It's clearly, everything about Jesus is completely against Pilate's expectations of what a king is. Jesus' answer in verse 33 is in effect to say, "It depends." It depends on what you mean by the question. Are you asking out of your own curiosity, or are you simply repeating the charges? Pilate's response confirms that he's just passing on the accusation. It's got nothing to do with him. So now Jesus can answer Pilate's question properly and challenge the political problem that the Jews have said he represents to Rome. Jesus explains that there is something bigger at stake than the political overthrow of Rome. He explains that his kingdom is not defined by a physical territory with borders. Otherwise, Jesus said, his arrest at the start of the chapter would have been met with resistance. The fact that Jesus was arrested so easily confirms that Jesus' kingship is different to the charges that have been presented. But in verse 37, Jesus does confirm that he is a king. Now, it's possible to read Jesus' statements, "You say that I'm a king," as meaning, "That's your word, not mine." So for the avoidance of doubt, it's worth clarifying that we know that from other Gospels that Jesus' answer is yes, it is as you say. Plus, there's an earlier translation in the NIV that renders Jesus' answer here in John as, "You are right in saying I am a king." So Jesus confirms he is a king. But he has not come as a rebel bent on overthrow. His job, the very reason he was born, is to testify to the truth. And whoever is for truth will listen to him. So, what does it mean that Jesus claims to testify to the truth? What image is conjured up for you when you hear that someone is going to testify? You probably think of someone giving evidence in the witness court, as a witness in court. Perhaps something like this. And this is true for Jesus too. His claim to testify to the truth means that he's bearing witness to the way things really are, and principally bearing witness to his own unique identity. Earlier in the book, in John 14, Jesus has made an audacious claim to his disciples that he is the way, the truth, and the life. So in other words, here in verse 37, Jesus claims that the reason he was born was to show people that he is God, and fundamentally to explain the truth about what matters to him, the reality of his judgment on humanity and his rescue plan. And this theme is something that we see repeatedly in John's book. There's a phrase said by Jesus that appears again and again. This version of the NIV has it translated as the phrase, "Very truly, I tell you." Older versions of the NIV translated as, "I tell you the truth," or, "What I'm about to tell you is true." Throughout the book of John, he notes 26 occasions when Jesus says this phrase. So all through the account of Jesus' life, he's been repeatedly testifying to the truth, pointing to the reality of his identity and his purposes. Here are three examples when Jesus uses this phrase, talking about his authority and identity. John 5, he says this, "What I'm about to tell you is true. The Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father do. What the Father does, the Son also does." Talking about salvation, his rescue plan, he says, "What I'm about to tell you is true. Anyone who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. He will not be found guilty. He has crossed over from death to life." And talking about the problem that we face, what I'm about to tell you is true. Everyone who sins is a slave of sin. The point is that standing in the dock, Jesus says that there is a bigger view of life, a bigger view of life than the here and now, and that he's come to bring the truth to us, to help us understand it, to see its consequences, and to give us the opportunity to listen and respond. And if his followers are characterized by their allegiance to his testimony rather than opposing Rome, Pilate has to recognize that Jesus is a victim of a conspiracy. He has no intention to overthrow the Romans. But it's clear in verse 38 that Pilate is not interested in hearing and abruptly ends the interrogation and with the question, "What is truth?" Now, how would you answer that question? We're going to consider a little bit about the nature of truth, but what is truth? Take a moment again to talk to your neighbour and try and answer Pilate's question. How would you answer Pilate? What is truth? Okay, always good to start with a definition. My dictionary had 5 definitions. Truth, the actual state of a matter. Conformity with fact or reality. A verified or indisputable fact, proposition, principle, or the like. The state or character of being true. Actuality or actual existence. How does your definition compare? Now, much of these definitions ring true for us when we think about issues of justice and law breaking, don't they? Truth is something that we can see being valued in society when it focuses on issues of right and wrong. None of us like being lied to. Think of the scandals that have hit the news recently. As ever, no shortage of them. Our politicians, the now ex-minister Chris Huhne and his former wife convicted of deception and lying in court. Think of the accusations of sex scandals that surround the likes of Jimmy Savile, the Lib Dem peer Lord Renard and Cardinal O'Brien, or the recent food scandal of horse meat in beef. In all these situations, we want to know the truth of the matter, don't we? We want any attempts to cover these things up to be brought out into the light so that justice can be seen to be done. We want these wrongs to be made right, for the victims to know justice, and for the perpetrators to experience the consequences of their own crime. That's a sense of justice. But there's also another kind of truth that many of us are familiar with. For many, truth changes when we consider lifestyle choices. We live in a very diverse community here in East London, and it's obvious that not everyone believes the same things about issues of life and death. There are lots of views about what life is about, which leads to a widely held view that no one has a full picture of what our true purpose is. The best example of this kind of truth that I could think of is typified by the title of an album released by a bunch of Welsh musicians. Not Ellie James. Any ideas? The 5th studio album of the Manic Street Preachers, and it's called This Is My Truth, Tell Me Yours. The essence of the album's title explains a pervading view of our day, that we all hold a personal view about truth, but none of us have the full picture. The conclusion is that no specific religion or view about the world has the right to claim to be the only. All positions are thought to be equally valid. So as you've shared your faith with your friends and family, you may have heard the response, it may be true for you, but it isn't true for me. Or, you can say that my view is wrong, it might be wrong for you, but it isn't wrong for me. A common illustration to get this point across is one where several blind men are trying to describe an elephant. One of the blind men feels the trunk and reports that an elephant is just like a snake, it's thin. Another feels a leg and claims that an elephant is as thick as a tree. Another touches its side and reports that the elephant is as solid as a brick wall. The story is supposed to represent how various religions can only understand part of God, while none of them can see the whole picture. If any of the blind men claim the full knowledge of God or of life and our purpose, they're thought to be arrogant and intolerant. So truth is often felt to be a personal and private thing, not something that anyone has the right to convert others to. And this is known as relativism. And it's built on the belief that nothing is certain. There's no absolute certainties, no absolute truth, and no absolute right and wrong. But the problem with this view is that it's completely inconsistent. It makes a claim about truth which it cannot hold for itself. Think about it. The only way that this story makes sense is if the person telling the story has seen the whole elephant. The storyteller is holding a vantage point similar to where you're sitting that allows them the view of the whole scene, the whole truth of the situation, a few blind men feeling the same animal. So at the point where our friends say all religions are only part of the truth, just like the blind men in the story, we should help them to see that they are claiming to hold the very knowledge they say no one else knows. They are suggesting that they have the whole picture, the absolute truth about the situation. In other words, to say that all truth is personal is itself an absolute truth statement, which is no longer relative. It has contradicted itself. Do you see? Does that make sense? And that contradiction is hugely significant. Let me explain. Here is a bust of a Greek philosopher called Aristotle, who lived roughly 300 years before the trial in John 18. He's thought to be one of the most important founding figures of Western philosophy. His writings cover many subjects, including physics, poetry, music, politics, ethics and biology. And one of the things he wrote about was logic, which is a process used for how we go about learning things and reaching conclusions. As part of his writings, he developed a principle which is called the law of non-contradiction. And that remains a foundation for the logic we use today. The principle basically says that a statement cannot be both true and false at the same time. Although complementary truth claims can be true, contradictory truth claims cannot. For example, I could make two claims about this stand. I can say, this stand is a piece of furniture, or this is a lectern. These claims are different, but they can both be true. They are complementary. They're given two different bits of information which can both be true. This is both a lectern and a piece of furniture. Make sense? But suppose I make two exclusive claims. This stand is made of wood, and this stand is made of gold. These beliefs cannot both be true, can they? They have contradicted each other. If one is true, the other cannot be. This stand cannot be made of wood and, at the same time, be made of gold. Does that make sense? The point is that in order to be able to say Christianity may be true for you, but it isn't true for me, you have to abandon this fundamental principle of logic and everything based on it. And when that happens, everything starts to unravel. Let's go back to consider Vicky Price, the ex-wife of Chris Hughne, who's recently been convicted for lying in court and perverting the course of justice. This is where our value of truth utterly depends on Aristotle's law of non-contradiction, doesn't it? Take two contradictory statements which the judge in her trial may have been presented with. You can imagine the prosecution saying, Vicky Price lied in court about the speeding rules. And the defence would have said something like, Vicky Price did not lie in court about the speeding rules. Both can't be right. It can't be right for me that she lied in court, and also at the same time right for Vincent that she didn't lie in court. The whole basis of justice would collapse. Either she lied or she didn't. That's the basis of her trial and her conviction. Now back to our trial in John 18. Jesus says, look again with me in verse 37, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Firstly, note that he doesn't say a truth. No, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Jesus' claim cannot be true for me and not true for you. Either his claim is true or it isn't. That's what Aristotle says. And had Jesus answered Pilate's question with his claim in John 14, I am the way, the truth, and the life, he makes a claim that is either true or it isn't. The law of non-contradiction, established 3 centuries earlier, won't allow Pilate, me, or you to say, that might be true for you, Jesus, but it isn't true for me. Instead, Pilate is forced to make a choice, to listen or not. And here, Jesus' point is crystal clear. Those who are interested in truth listen to him. Those who aren't won't. So, a choice needs to be made. Verse 38, Pilate has understood that Jesus represents no political threat to Rome and declares the charges unfounded. But he doesn't go as far as to choose to side with truth. Pilate doesn't close the case and release Jesus. Instead, he gives the crowd the choice of Jesus' fate. Who should they side with? A known rebel called Barabbas or Jesus, who Pilate declares is innocent? The crowd face a choice, so do we. John, in his book, wrote down a challenge to his readers in chapter 20. He said this: these events are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, that by believing you may have life in his name. John wants us to consider Jesus' testimony, to read his own eyewitness account about Jesus' life, and to decide for ourselves whether Jesus should be listened to. You ever done that? Taking the time to read a whole gospel cover to cover like you would any other book? And what have you done with the questions that it's raised for you? Have you looked for answers and brushed them aside? Are you a truth seeker or someone who prefers to live in ignorance? Your answer, John says, has a profound eternal consequence. Why? Well, consider the timing of the trial. At the start of our reading, in verse 28, John tells us it's the time of the Passover festival. Many of us may know that the Passover is an overwhelmingly significant event in the Old Testament, one which God commanded should be remembered each year as a festival. It's a shocking and stunning event carried out at the time when the Jews had been slaves in Egypt for over 400 years. God calls Moses to plead for their release, but Pharaoh, thought to be a god by the Egyptians, refuses repeatedly to listen until the Passover happens. You can read about it firsthand in the first 15 chapters of Exodus. In short, the Lord brings judgment over Egypt because of their stubborn refusal to obey him and release the Jews from slavery. In a devastating climax to the event, God demonstrates his ultimate control over life by killing the firstborn of every household. And only those whose door frames are painted with the blood from a sacrificed lamb are spared the dreadful judgment. Exodus records that the Lord saw the blood of the lamb painted on the door and passed over the household, sparing those inside from the terrifying punishment. The death of the lamb stood in the place of the death of the firstborn. And finally, Pharaoh relented and the Jews were released from slavery. Now the whole event is a symbol for the reality, the truth of the world. The Bible says that in a similar way to the Egyptians, we all live under the shadow of God's judgment because of our stubborn refusal to listen to him. Remember one of Jesus' truth statements where he describes us as being slaves to our rebellion, our sin. Everyone who sins is a slave of sin. At the end of this trial in John 18, Jesus will be led to his death. In the first chapter of this book, John the Baptist sees Jesus coming towards him and says, "Look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." John the Baptist understood, and so did John the author, that Jesus' death stands in the place of ours, like the lamb in the original Passover. So we know that if we do not put our trust in the blood of the true Passover lamb, like the Jews in Exodus, we will face a similar fate to the Egyptians. If we refuse to listen to God's testimony, to Jesus' testimony, we will meet the full force of God's judgment. But to any who listen to the truth and put their trust in Jesus' death, the shedding of his blood guarantees that God will pass over us when his final judgment comes. So the trial is set during the Passover festival, and Jesus claims that anyone on the side of truth listens to him. So it's up to each one of us to consider Jesus' testimony, to read the account firsthand, and to decide for ourselves whether he is the true king to be followed and the Passover lamb who spares us from God's judgment. It's either true or it isn't. What's your view?